Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, I got a fun one for you. Oh boy, a lot of Hillary and Bernie, a lot of Donald Trump. I'm hitting you from all angles today. So right off the bat here, we're gonna get to the specifics on Hillary versus Bernie and what people perceive as a weakness versus a strength. And there's this massive new caveat about Hillary Clinton's strengths that can really undermine her campaign, and it actually, in part, explains the rise of Bernie Sanders and why he's surging in the polls. Chelsea Clinton's also out there on the campaign trail, not doing Hillary any favors, even though that she's trying to do that. We have public policy polling doing some research into Trump supporters in South Carolina, and shock, shock, they are deeply bigoted and actually quite literally anti-American. Many of them are just flat out anti-American. If you don't know exactly what that means, stick around, baby. You'll see. You'll see. I'll break it all down for you. Ted Cruz's father is on the campaign trail, stopped off with his fundamentalist buddy, Pat Robertson, and they sat around and yucked it up together and made no sense. Glenn Beck is also campaigning for Ted Cruz, or he's, you know, on the trail here with Ted Cruz, and he's just shamelessly making stuff up now. I think we're going to have a first in secular talk history today. I will be defending Fox News. Now, of course, there's context to that. It's because Glenn Beck is making shit up about them, so there's actually a reason to do it, but nonetheless, very interesting. And much more, including Ronda Rousey, the number one female fighter in the world who was kind of dethroned when she lost her undefeated record recently. We'll talk a little bit about what she went through after that, and maybe we'll learn some valuable life lessons. Cue the sappy music in the background. All right, let's get started here, and we'll do that with Hillary and Bernie and what's going on with them. Huffington Post is out with some interesting new facts on the race between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. Now, clearly, Hillary is viewed as having the upper hand on foreign policy, but there's this massive new caveat to add to that now. So they report the following, quote, in a new HuffPost YouGov poll, 59% of likely Democratic primary voters say that Hillary would do a very good job of handling foreign policy as president. Just 23% say the same of Bernie. Okay, now, again, here's the perceived strength of Hillary Clinton and the weakness of Bernie Sanders, but just how much does that matter? Well, they continue here. But foreign policy in any form is far from the top of most Democratic voters' minds. An overwhelming majority, 79%, say that economic policy is of more concern than foreign policy in their decision this year. Damn. So what that means is her perceived biggest strength might be somewhat irrelevant. And it's even worse for her because when you get to the economy, his message is resonating. Now, before I get to that, let me pause here on this idea of foreign policy for a second. So the reasons why people say Hillary is so much better is very simply experience. I mean, she was Secretary of State. She has commanding knowledge of the players involved around the world. But Bernie has this line that he always uses against her in the debates, and I think he's right when he says, yeah, she has experience. Nobody's going to deny she has more experience than me on this. But judgment is what matters. And when it comes to judgment, I actually go even further than Bernie Sanders does. I think that Hillary Clinton is a disaster on foreign policy in every imaginable way. I wouldn't give her credit for any. I don't give her credit for her Syria position. I don't give her credit for her Iran position. I don't give her credit, obviously, for Iraq. She voted for the Iraq war. So she's dead wrong on every foreign policy issue. But so what? Oh, she was Secretary of State, and she has more knowledge of the players involved. That means bupkis. That doesn't mean anything to me. Now, again, you could say the reverse for Bernie. He might not know all the players involved as intricately as Hillary does, but he's right at the core of it. And the core of it is, hey, let's only really use our troops for self-defense. You know, let's not send young men and women from Nebraska and Kentucky and California to go die overseas for no goddamn good reason. And even the stuff that he gets the most shit on, I think he's right. So when he talks about how, hey, we should move faster to mend fences with Iran, and then we should work with Iran to defeat ISIS, Hillary scoffs at that. She's like, oh, yeah, no, that's stupid. Why would you even do that? I mean, we need to fight. We need to be against Iran, and we need to be against Assad in Syria, and we need to be against ISIS. Okay, well, then you're just taking the neoconservative position. That's all that is. You're just taking Jeb Bush's position. I'm against everybody, and we should fight everybody. Okay, well, then you are advocating for a quagmire in Syria, the same as in Iraq, when you had George W. Bush wanting to fight the Sunnis and the Shias in the Civil War there. So why is it better when Hillary proposes that same kind of idea in Syria? That's not better. In fact, that's just as bad as it was then, and you're not going to win in the long run. She also has called at times for a no-fly zone, and she does this trick where she says, no ground troops, but I would have a no-fly zone. Well, a no-fly zone requires ground troops. So that's a sneaky workaround to wanting to put boots on the ground, as you say you don't want to put boots on the ground. So she's just wrong. Whereas Bernie says, look, as much as I despise the dictator Assad, I'm not in favor of regime change. Look at what happened when we did regime change in Iraq and we got rid of Saddam Hussein. Terrible guy, brutal dictator, but he stabilized the region. So why not have, I don't know, Iranian troops do our dirty work for us in fighting ISIS? But see, Hillary Clinton views, and she admits this too in a foreign policy letter that her supporters released. She says, no, we view the world as a chessboard, which is why we're better than Bernie. No, but I think that would make you worse than Bernie, because it's the chessboard mentality that prevents you from making common sense decisions. So she's against, fighting ISIS first, because we can't align with the Syrian forces, Assad, Iran, and Russia, who are all against the rebels who are Islamists and jihadists. So she's trying to do the old Obama move of, we need to find the moderate rebels to support and back them, and then everything will work out, except they're mythical. Obama set up a program to do that. You know how many people he got? 4. That's literal. Started out with a few thousand, dwindled down, and then by the end we had 4 so-called moderate rebels in Syria that were going to fight to try to topple Assad and fight ISIS. No, see, they're aligned with each other. You have the Islamists and jihadists aligned with each other. So she's living in fairy tale land when she says, oh, we'll carve out a moderate rebel faction, that'll work out, and gosh, isn't it great, I know so much about foreign policy. And Bernie, meanwhile, is also willing, as he's, done in the debates, to be tough on Saudi Arabia. You can't have a serious conversation about stopping jihadism around the world and Salafism unless you talk about doing something on the Saudi Arabia front, whether it's economic consequences or you stop arming them to kill innocent civilians in Yemen, as Hillary Clinton is fine with. But they pretend like Saudi Arabia is not a big player in terrorism, even though they were partly responsible for 9/11. They've funded jihadist groups and Salafism all around the world. But Hillary acts like, we can't talk about that because they're our oil buddy. So that's the kind of chessboard she's talking about. We're going to align with really shitty people because they're the ones who are on our side for business interests and imperialism interests. So vote for me, I'm better than Bernie. No, Bernie is significantly better. He actually gives a shit about human rights, you know, that crazy thing? And he gives a shit about not using our troops unless we absolutely have to. So this perceived idea of weakness, I don't agree with. I think it's this naive establishment talking point that's just a reflexive thing. I don't know if she was Secretary of State, she's better by definition. Or not. Look at her actual record. And on her record, it's regime change fucking everywhere. It's, okay, let's get involved in Iraq. Okay, she was hawkish on Iran. Now she takes credit for the deal, even though she didn't want to negotiate with them in the first place. On Libya, she wanted to do regime change, and we did. So she's like, oh, vote for me, liberals, even though I'm kind of like a neoconservative. But vote for me, and aren't I better than Bernie? No, you're not. All right, so that's foreign policy. Now let's get to the economy. They say the following, quote, back in 2013, only 20% of potential Democratic primary voters thought Clinton would be too accommodating to Wall Street and big banks. In the latest survey, it's now risen to 37%, compared to just 12% who say the same of Bernie Sanders. Damn! So that means Bernie Sanders' message is resonating. Only 20% of Democrats in 2013 said Hillary's going to help Wall Street. We know her record. We see how much money she's taken. She's going to help Wall Street. Now it's 37%, nearly doubled that. That means almost half of Democrats, basically 4 in 10 Democrats, are like, yeah, she's too close with Wall Street. What's changed in the time from 2013 to now? Not only her taking more speaking fees and being openly corrupt, but also Bernie Sanders going, legalize bribery, you're taking the money, you're on the side of Wall Street, I see what you're doing, I see what you're doing, I see what you're doing. And then the American people listening, some of us listening and going, yeah, that guy's right. Yeah, that guy's 100% right. So what Hillary's perceived biggest strength is might not even help her, because 79% say I'm not as big on that issue as I am on the economy. And then when you pivot to the economy, Bernie Sanders in many areas is crushing her. And then we haven't even brought up the other polls, which bring up the trustworthy factor, which is Hillary Clinton consistently ranks super low when it comes to do you trust that person or not, whereas somebody like Bernie Sanders always ranks high in that. So do we have a race on our hands? Fuck yeah, we have a race on our hands. We had Bernie basically tie in Iowa. He won in a landslide in New Hampshire. Now, he's struggling in some of the polls upcoming, like in South Carolina, for example. But in Nevada, there was just a recent poll that said he tied. Again, I maintain that it's a questionable source because it was the polling was commissioned by a very far right-wing website. Now, the firm they used is not right-wing, and they typically do good work. But I always asterisk next to any story that comes from a far-right website. It's usually garbage. But did he at least chip away at her lead in Nevada? Oh, you bet your ass. You bet your ass that he did. So we'll see, man. Moving forward here, we got a race on our hands. And the more you read into the details of what's happening, the more you think this is closer than any of us could have imagined. Okay. Now, let's get to Chelsea Clinton and see what's going on with her. Chelsea Clinton is on the campaign trail for her mom, and she's continuing to do her no favors, even though the whole goal is to do her favors and try to help her out. The opposite is happening. So the Independent reports here, quote, Chelsea Clinton said Senator Bernie Sanders' proposal to end mass incarceration in the U.S. is worrying, and insinuated that her mother's rival does not understand what is possible to achieve in government. So here's some more of what she said. Quote, we are not electing a king. We are electing a president. We need someone who understands what they have to do in the job as president, but also in partnership with Congress, governors, and mayors. My mother understands how the government works. Interesting. So look at the strategy that they're taking. They're making the same mistake they made with Obama in 2008. He's the hope and change guy. He's the yes, we can guy. I'm the maybe, just a little bit. You got to work from within the system and be pragmatic. You know, don't go crazy here and actually ask for democratic proposals, overwhelmingly popular proposals that the American people want. Pump your brakes, okay? I'm going to level with you and say, probably going to get none of it. What's the massive flaw in that logic? You're conceding up front. Think about it. This is the opposite of what the Republicans do. The Republicans go in there, and they're like, yeah, here's what we're going to do. We're going to get rid of the death tax. They call it the death tax. It's really the estate tax, and it only applies to people with fucking estates. We're going to get rid of the death tax. We're going to get rid of all the regulations on Wall Street. We're going to do this and that and this and that. And they're so strident and firm in that position that the Democrats end up fucking caving and going all the way to them, and the compromise is always on their terms. Whereas the Democrats do the opposite. Bill Clinton, President Obama, and obviously now Hillary Clinton. Look at what they did with health care. This is the go-to example because it illustrates it perfectly. They didn't start out by saying single payer, which is the true Democratic position. They started out by saying maybe a public option. Not even public option, this is non-negotiable. Maybe a public option. And then eventually they went from what should have been the compromise position, the public option, all the way to let's do your old right-wing proposal that Richard Nixon came up with first, and then right-wing think tanks like the Heritage Foundation wrote about in the 1990s. It's what Newt Gingrich used to support and Chuck Grassley used to support. It's mandating that people go to private insurance companies to buy their insurance. It's the individual mandate. It's a right-wing idea. But see, they conceded up front, and then the negotiation was on the terms of the Republicans. So the middle ground was now or just a right-wing idea. Bernie Sanders, yeah, he might not get everything he wants. Now, some things he actually will get what he wants because there's executive orders and there's other ways of going about this. But if he goes in there and he starts with a non-negotiable position of single-payer health care for everybody, Medicare for all, let's say he doesn't get that. You know what the compromise becomes? Public option. So now we have a much better, much more liberal piece of legislation than what Obama would have offered and what Hillary Clinton is telling you she's going to do. She's saying up front, look, yeah, I'm not, progressive position, fuck that. That's not, you know, you're too naive and pie in the sky, you crazy progressive. Let's be pragmatic and moderate here. And then again, like I always, she makes this argument half the time. Then the other half the time, what does she say? On Wall Street, for example, with Bernie, my plan goes further than Bernie Sanders. Wait, which is it? Are you the pragmatic moderate one, or do you go further than Bernie? And oh my God, you're so immensely progressive. It's just she flip-flops all over the place. She does this on the same issues, too. Like one day on some issues, she'll be like, no, I'm more moderate. And then the next day, she's like, no, I'm more progressive. Which is it? Which is it, Hillary? Make your fucking mind up. There is no core to Hillary Clinton. There is no, hey, these are my values, these are my principles. She listens to the donors. Don't get me wrong, man. Whenever I do these rants, I can sense that there are people in the audience who are like, just say it. Say that she's better than Republicans. Okay, boom, I'll say it right here. Would I rather have a President Hillary Clinton or President Rick Santorum? Hillary Clinton, obviously. President Hillary Clinton or President Mike Huckabee? Ted Cruz? Yeah, Hillary Clinton. No question about it. But that's not praise. That's just duh. That's like, hey, you're the tallest kid in kindergarten. That doesn't mean you're fucking tall, does it? And if you have a choice in a primary between Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton, what fucking choice is that? Are you kidding me? Now, let's go further here, because what exactly is Bernie Sanders' proposal when it comes to ending mass incarceration? And I love how the Chelsea Clinton, it's worrying to get rid of mass incarceration. No, you know what's worrying? Fucking mass incarceration. That's what's worrying. When you lock up people for doing drugs, when we should all file that under hashtag freedom. So here's exactly what Bernie Sanders wants to do. Quote, Senator Sanders proposes abolishing private prisons for profit, which have an incentive to lock up more people, to legalize marijuana, and to eliminate mandatory minimums for drug-related crimes, which result in sentencing disparities between black and white people. Okay, no part of that is wrong. And some of these are perhaps possible, too. Now, maybe not early on because you have an overwhelming, Republican lead in the House and the Senate. You know, perhaps by a Bernie Sanders second term, you can get a lot of this stuff done here because some of these were creeping towards bipartisanship on them. The more libertarian Tea Party wing of the Republican Party, they're starting to come around on sentencing reform too. So abolishing private prisons, yeah, it's a no-brainer to not have the profit motive in prisons because then you have an incentive to lock more people up. What a grotesque, perverse incentive. This is where you get stuff like three strike laws from. Because three strike laws, what is it? Oh, you committed three minor felonies. We're going to lock you up forever. Why? Because some private prison lobbied the government to try to pass this law because they need asses in bed so they can make more money. That's beyond fucked up, that system. It makes no sense. There's a reason why private prisons historically have been scoffed at because this is part and parcel of what a government function is. You don't want an incentive to lock more people up. All right, legalizing marijuana. Well, we have some states that already did that. We have Obama moving forward on releasing some nonviolent drug criminals. This is the trends of history. He's riding it. Hillary Clinton and Chelsea Clinton are fighting it. When it comes to getting rid of mandatory minimums, yeah, you need to give judges leeway to use logic and reason to go, hey, wait a second. You know, it says I need to lock this person up for a minimum of 5 years for doing whatever, selling a certain amount of drugs. How about no? How about this, you know, this is no different than somebody who sells alcohol for a living and that CEO has a mansion in Maui. No, this isn't something that should be punitive and we should punish in a criminal way. That's just crazy. So there you have it, man. Chelsea Clinton, coming out to bat for her mom and doing a horrific job. Now, let's go to Donald Trump, and I'll tell you what's going on with him. There's a great article in Reuters breaking down one of the rhetorical tricks that Donald Trump uses to his advantage. They say that abruptly ending sentences or substituting vague words for what should be more specific words is something that he does, and it actually has a name. It's called an enthymeme. I never heard of this until yesterday when I was reading this article here. So here's what they report. To his followers or to his supporters, Trump is a politician who doesn't sound like one. He says what he thinks, happily insults rivals, and can appear unscripted, particularly when he leaves his thoughts to trail off unfinished or pepper sentences with ambiguities. Take his comments during a recent Republican debate in which he defended his call for a temporary ban on Muslims entering the United States. He said, "I talked about Muslims. We have to have a temporary something because there's something going on that's not good." That's such a Trumpian sentence. "It was left up to the listener to decipher what Trump was saying. What this means, in practice, is that supporters can tailor his statements to their own beliefs," rhetoric professors said. "Enthymemes can have a potent effect on listeners. You have involved them psychologically and helped to persuade them by having them persuade themselves." Okay, that is 100% correct. And the way they framed it here is actually brilliant, that you get the listener involved psychologically because you've helped persuade them by having them persuade themselves. That is so true. And this goes back to something that I've been arguing for a while now, and as far as I know, I was the only person arguing this. The third part of this, I should say. The first two other people were arguing, but one of the reasons why he's doing so well is his confidence. The other reason is his anti-establishment facade. Now, again, it is a facade. He said, "I'm self-funding. I'm doing this. I'm doing that." No, no. He went and begged the billionaires to fund him, and they just said no. It was only after they said no that he was like, "Oh, yeah, money in politics is screwed up, man, because they don't want me to participate in it. But, yeah, that's why it's messed up. So I'm self-funding. I'm doing all this stuff." He wanted to be just as corrupt as everybody else, but they didn't want to give him money. So it's the anti-establishment facade. And then the part that I've argued that I haven't seen anybody else argue, and this comes close to that argument I made, is his contradictions are actually a benefit for him. And it's a benefit because the Republican base doesn't really care about logic. And so if you contradict yourself, whatever. It allows people to read into his statements whatever the fuck they want to read into his statements. So one day he'll come out there and say, "We need to bomb the hell out of ISIS and we need to destroy them. And we need to go so far that we even attack the families of ISIS, women and children, advocating war crimes. This is only as far right-wing an idea you can have, and it's just out-and-out criminal." But then the next day he'll come out and say, "You know, Vladimir Putin, he's fighting ISIS. Why not let him do the work? I got no problem with him doing the work. You know, we should stay out and rebuild our infrastructure here at home." Okay, that's a complete contradiction to what you said the day before, where you said, "Let's bomb ISIS and their families." So what happens? Well, to people who have logic and who actually look at policy specifics to determine who to vote for, they go, "Okay, this guy doesn't know whether he's coming or going. He's a buffoon. He's a mess. And he doesn't even know what he's going to do. He's just talking. And he keeps contradicting himself, and he's ridiculous." But to Republican-based voters, what, you think they're going into depth on policy details? No, they just, whichever statement they liked more, they'll latch onto that one. And that's what they do. And Trump does this all the time. He'll say, "We need single-payer health care." Or he used to say that before he ran for office. And then now he says, "You know, we need the government to take care of the worst off among us, and the government's going to pay for it." Okay, so you're talking about a form of single-payer health care. He'll say that. And then in the next sentence, he'll say, "The reforms we should do is allow people to buy across state lines, and free enterprise is the answer." Those are contradictory. Which is it? You want the government or you want free enterprise? You want single-payer or you want some capitalist system? But he contradicts himself, so what happens? People read in whatever the fuck they want to read in. If you're on the side of, "Yeah, I think the government should do health care. Then you'll latch onto that part. If you're on the side of, no, yeah, free market, then you'll latch onto that part. And this is exactly what they're saying with how he structures his sentences. When they're purposefully vague and he cuts himself off early, what he's doing is he's allowing his listeners and his followers, his supporters who aren't that bright, to fill in the blanks in their own mind. So when you're super vague, people go, oh, I think he's saying what I want him to have said there, even though he didn't really say anything that's very specific. I'm telling you, man, Donald Trump is a case study in the new era of politics. And even Bernie Sanders is a case study in the new era of politics. And the only, I mean, they're absolutely nothing alike, don't get me wrong. On policy, Bernie makes sense. Donald Trump has no clue what the fuck he's doing. But in terms of the style, there's this perception of both of them of, oh, straight shooter, telling it like it is. They've ripped up the old playbook of be the smarmy politician with the same rhythm and cadence and inflection and tone when you talk. And, you know, you have to be like the establishment, offend nobody. No, no. That's now, those days are done, man. Now, millennials are the people who are going to be really involved in the political system. The silent generation is dying off. The baby boomers are super old. So, you know, what's going on here is that we have young people who are just different. And I don't know what to attribute it to. I don't know if it's the internet or, I mean, I think that has something to do with it, the easily accessible information so you can get facts and you care enough to look it up. I don't know if it's that or I don't know what it is, but people now, they yearn for that kind of talk. They yearn for people who feel off script because they are off script. And I sense even myself, you know, when I have to edit the segments and stuff and upload them to YouTube, I'll notice that when I'm going through something and I got a quote for you or I got to give you a segment of an article, that part connects less in my mind than the part where I'm just talking off the cuff. So why wouldn't that universalize to other people around my generation and my age, where they can listen more and it clicks more when I'm just talking as opposed to when I'm quoting something for you and reading? Well, that's Donald Trump and that's Bernie Sanders. Hey, yeah, this is what I believe, this is my principles, and you just go. Whereas compare that to somebody like the Marco bot. The Marco bot is so scripted that he might actually have contact lenses on where he's reading in his fucking contacts. And I believe in families, and I believe in God is great, and I thank the good Lord George W. Bush was president. What are you doing? Martin O'Malley, same thing. Overly scripted, let me tell you how I talk. I am a politician. We don't like that anymore, and this is just another example of it right here. All right, stay right there, guys. We'll be right back with a whole bunch of stuff, including just how bigoted are Trump's voters? The answer, very, very, very bigoted. Guys, we're back. For those of you who don't know, I've mentioned this a few times already, but the reason why earlier shows this week is I had a bunch of appointments and stuff that I had to do at, like, around the time that the show normally is. So I had the option of doing no shows or just pushing it way earlier. So I went with the push it way earlier option because I don't want to do no shows. So it's kind of like a test run here. I don't know. There's upsides and downsides to it. Number one, I feel horrible for the people on the West Coast. I've already gotten tweets from some people on the West Coast. They're like, dude, come on. I like listening to the show, but goddamn, for them, it starts at 8 o'clock, which is ridiculous. I don't want to hear myself at 8 o'clock. So it sucks for them. It also sucks for my hair. Because I shower later in the day. So I just have a fucking Brillo pad, a puffy Brillo pad on top of my head. And it's kind of grotesque. I hate the way it looks. But there are upsides, too. The upsides are I get to actually finish overall a little earlier. And I don't know exactly why that is. I guess when the show's at 4, I can do all my prep, and then I got to wait a little bit sometimes for the show, like wait a little longer. And then I do the show, and then I got to, upload and edit and stuff. So I don't know exactly what's why it is faster this way, but still haven't made my mind up if this is going to be – this is just supposed to be for this week, but at the end of the week, I'm going to determine whether or not I want to keep it at this time. I know that people on the East Coast don't mind it. The West Coast hates it, and I know people overseas love it. Because, I guess people in the UK, people in various parts of Asia, this is at more like a normal time for them, where it's usually, I guess, super late at night for them, if I had kept this show at 4. So I haven't made my mind up yet, but we'll see. Still feeling it out here. Anyway, let's jump into Donald Trump's followers and some new information on them. And they're kind of exactly what you expected. Public policy polling decided to do some research into Trump voters in South Carolina. And the findings are incredible. So they report, quote, 44% of Trump's supporters think Islam should be banned in the United States. 40% would shut down mosques. And around 60% said a national database of Muslims should be established. Okay, so let's pause and reflect on this for a second. That's all unconstitutional. Every single one of those things. You can't ban a religion. That would violate the Constitution. You can't shut down houses of worship. That would violate the Constitution. And you can't set up a national database. That would violate the Constitution. And what's hilarious is this is the party that wraps themselves in the Constitution like, oh, not debatable, man. Let me tell you. They'll talk about the Second Amendment. Now, they don't even know the history of the Second Amendment, and they don't even go by the literal text of the Second Amendment. So they're even off in their belief on that. But what they say on that is, oh, not debatable, off the table. That's why it's in the Constitution. Off the table, off the table, off the table. But then when it comes to protecting the rights of minority groups, Constitution, smonstitution, I loves me some fascism. Let's just shut it down and quiet them. Okay, let me ask everybody a question out there. If this isn't bigoted, what is? What is? Now, I've often said, and I talk about this all the time on the show, I'm against all of the religions. I don't think any of them are true, and I think, honestly, they're a little silly. If you happen to believe that these things actually hold truths about the universe and about reality, no, that's utter nonsense. But I'm against the ideologies, the religious ideologies. So because I'm against Christianity doesn't mean I'm against all Christians. Of course, I believe in your right to practice Christianity as long as you're not taking away the rights of others. Same thing. I'm against Islam. I don't believe in Islam, but I'm not against all Muslims. I believe in the right of Muslims to practice their religion as long as they're not taking away the rights of other people. These guys say, no, no, no nuance. Christians good. Christianity good. They want to shove Christianity down our throats via the government. But Islam, we're not even going to allow you to practice it if you're not taking away other people's rights. You're just not allowed to be Muslim and be in the U.S. We want to shut down mosques. We want to have a database for you. So don't tell me this isn't generalizing. This is the definition of generalizing. When you say 60% of them say, a majority, a big majority say, have a national database of Muslims. What you're saying is, guilty enough. Guilty enough. You're Muslim. That's enough for you to be, ISIS-like. So that's it. It's over. Shut down all your mosques, houses of worship. So do me a favor. All the people on the right who would pretend to love the Constitution, shut the fuck up. Or read the goddamn thing and understand that people have rights in this country. All right, so that's the first part. Then they say, quote, 16% of Mr. Trump supporters believed white people were a superior race. This was more than any of the other candidates' supporters. No, you don't say. Now, Trump had retweeted neo-Nazis at least 2 times. Coverage did this get in the mainstream media? Hardly any at all. You think maybe the mainstream media should call out shit like that and say, whoa, what's going on here, man? This is, you're way outside of the bounds of respectability for an election cycle here. What are you doing? You're fucking retweeting neo-Nazis? That's not just a, whoops! That's not just a, you know, my bad. So I treated I retweeted a graphic that's factually inaccurate that says black people do an absurd percentage of the murders that wasn't true. We fact-checked it, okay? Whatever, just get over it. No, this is dangerous now. This is dangerous. Guys, 16%. More. Basically what that means is about 2 out of 10, either 1 out of 10 or 2 out of 10, thereabouts, of Trump supporters you talk to would say, yeah, white people are superior. Man, that's unbelievable. Now, I still, believe it or not, I haven't even gotten to the craziest part. Here we go. A full 70% of his supporters feel the Confederate flag should still be flying over the state capitol building in Columbia. It was lowered last July after a huge protest by those who said it was a symbol of racism. And 38% wished the South had won the Civil War. 38%, basically 4 out of 10 Trump supporters, would tell you the South should have won the Civil War. 4 out of 10 Trump supporters were like, perhaps slavery should have stayed around longer. Okay. The inescapable conclusion from this is 38% of Trump supporters are un-American. 38% of Trump supporters are un-American. If you think the South should have won the Civil War, the Confederacy should have won the Civil War, you are quite literally in favor of America breaking up, having two separate countries, the North and the South, the Confederate States of America, and you would be on the side of the Confederate States, not the United States, the North. So you're un-American. And what's always hilarious is that these are the guys who pretend to be the most patriotic and who wrap themselves in the flag and say, oh, yeah, America's great, America's perfect. You know, there's liberals who always blame America first. They're anti-American, man. 38% of you just said you would break up America and you want the South to have won. Unbelievable, man. I mean, call it what it is. These are racist. These are bigots. These are intolerant people, and everything we've been saying about them from day one is accurate. They don't care about contradictions. That's part of Trump's appeal. He contradicts himself all the time on policy. They don't give a shit. They're not about logic. They're not about reason. They just latch on to the authoritarian personality, the over-the-top confidence that's arrogance. They go, oh, I like that. he's going to stand up to everybody and he's going to be on my side, except he's not going to be on your side. You know, this is authoritarianism 101. This guy's a narcissist. He's a buffoon. The idea that he actually has high-minded policy solutions that'll make your life better. No. I mean, even on shit like wages, he said we need to keep low wages in this country. And you think that guy's on your side when probably the overwhelming majority of his supporters are either middle class or poor? Come on, man. Come on. I need you to not be stupid, okay? But that's a lot to ask for people who have these percentages when the pollsters ask them very weird and telling questions. All right, now let's go to Ted Cruz and one of his campaign surrogates and the bullshit that they're spewing. A surrogate for the Ted Cruz campaign went on MSNBC and was asked a pretty direct question about secularism, and his answer is terrifying.
Pastor Gonzalez, what do you say to Americans who are more secular who say what we don't want is to have a president in the White House who is essentially using his own personal faith to run the country when the Constitution has a separation of church and state?
Well, the reality of it is this idea of the separation of church and state is a myth. I mean, you bring your faith into the marketplace just like you do anything else. And so Ted Cruz will be a president, not just, you know, who is a preacher or pastor in the White House. That's not the idea. But I believe that all people, all Americans can rally around Ted Cruz because he upholds the Constitution. And I believe all Americans want to truly uphold the law.
Okay, he said separation of church and state is a myth. And then he said, fear not, Ted Cruz will uphold the Constitution. Wait, but separation of church and state is in the Constitution. So for you to say he'll uphold it, but he just won't, you know, do the separation of church and state thing, well, then he's not upholding it. It's that simple. That doesn't make any sense. Now, really? This is the conversation we're having in 2016? Separation of church and state is a myth, this guy says. It's a myth. Let's go to, the very first sentence of the First Amendment. It says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So you know what that means? The government cannot establish a religion. So it can't say Christianity is the state religion and anything else is not, or it can't pick particular branches. Lutheranism, Protestantism, Catholicism, whatever. You can't pick that over other branches of Christianity. You can't pick religion over non-religion. So you cannot establish a religion. That is secularism. And then the second part of that just means we're not going to prohibit the free exercise of religion. So if you want to practice your religion, you have every right to practice your religion. The government's not going to stop you. You do whatever the fuck you want to do. It only becomes a problem when you try to force your religion on other people via law. So this is secularism 101. In the first part of the First Amendment is almost the very definition of secularism. Now, if that's not enough to convince you, which, you know, you have to have a brick for a head if that doesn't convince you, but let me give you more here. Thomas Jefferson wrote a letter to the Danbury Baptists wherein he said the following while describing the First Amendment, quote, believing with you that religion is a matter which lies solely between man and his God, the whole American people, which declared that their legislature should make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state. Okay, so Thomas Jefferson, founding father, goes, yeah, if it wasn't clear enough, let me spell it out for you. This part of the First Amendment here that we're discussing, that means there is a wall of separation between church and state. It is secularism. It is the very definition of secularism. What does this jackass say? It's a myth. It's a myth, even though it's literally the first sentence of the First Amendment. It's a myth. No. It's not like there are any founding fathers like Thomas Jefferson literally saying the phrase, we have a wall of separation between church and state. Stop, 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 stop. No, see, these guys are theocrats. They're theocrats. they don't believe in a very important principle that was established at our founding here. And they do have a lot more in common with Saudi Arabia or Iran than they do with the United States of America. And that's fine, but just admit it. Just come out there and say, Allahu Akbar, say it. Come out there and say, I agree that the U.S. should be a Christian version of Saudi Arabia or a Christian version of Iran. And wear it on your sleeve, men. But let's be clear about the facts here, which is you'd have to fundamentally rework America and make it the opposite of what it is in order to do that. Okay. Now we move along to Glenn Beck and his shameless lying on the campaign trail as he's stumping for Ted Cruz. Glenn Beck is on the campaign trail for Ted Cruz in South Carolina, and he's shamelessly making stuff up. So according to The Blaze, which is his own website here, he explained why he got fired from Fox News. This is his new version of why he got fired from Fox News. He said, quote, "I swore I was never going to tell this story. Here's one of the real reasons I left Fox News. I was called into an office and I was told, stop talking about God. Yeah, I'm sure, Glenn. I was told, stop telling people to pray. I was told not to tell people to pray on their knees because there's a lot of people in the audience, their knees hurt and I make them feel bad. That one might actually be true because Fox's audience is ancient. I was told to stop praying because that takes God's focus off the important things like war. I was like, uh-huh, wow, I thought I was going to get this speech at CNN. Okay, that is one of the most made-up things I've ever read. Now, you guys know I am a gigantic opponent of Fox News. I can't stand Fox News. But today we will do a secular talk first, and I will be defending Fox News. And I'm defending Fox News from Glenn Beck, who is an even bigger maniac than they are. Glenn, we know why you're off the air. It ain't got nothing to do with that. So for those of you who don't know, Glenn Beck was losing his fucking mind the longer his show was on the air. And it was getting really creepy even by Fox News standards. I mean, this guy made Bill O'Reilly look like Noam Chomsky at points. And there was one particularly noteworthy incident when he was on Fox and Friends, and he argued that President Obama, you know, maybe he's racist against white people. He has a deep-seated hatred of white people. He threw that out there. When he made that comment, along with many previous comments that already had him questionable in the eyes of management, advertisers fled from his show because those comments blew up, and everybody got a hold of them, and everybody was running them nonstop, and they're like, look at this fucking maniac calling Obama racist against white people. The overwhelming majority of his cabinet is white, you jackass! Are you crazy? Advertisers ran, 20 big money advertisers fled from his show. Now, you know what happens when that's the case? It's over. It's over. You're not going to last on TV when your advertisers run away. Another good example of this, not that there's any real comparison between Glenn Beck and Bill Maher, but Bill Maher, when he was on, I think it was ABC, and he got fired from his show Politically Incorrect, his ratings actually went up, but his advertisers ran when he made the comment that the people who hit the towers were not cowards. They're evil, they're bad people, but they're not cowards. They stayed in a plane as it hit the fucking World Trade Center. So his ratings went up, but advertisers fled, so he was kicked off the air. Beck, I don't even know what his rating situation was like, but I know the advertisers ran away. So when they run away, that's it. And Fox News was kind enough to Glenn Beck to let him save face, to save a career in this business if he wanted to do something in the business in the future, where they let him have this show at the end where he's like, oh, yes, we're splitting amicably, and it's my time to move on, I've decided, and made it seem like, okay, he's the one who made the decision. He didn't make the decision. We all read all the articles. All the advertisers ran, so he was fucking kicked off the air. Now to save face and spread this narrative of Christian persecution, he's like, they didn't want me to pray at Fox News. Really? Fucking Fox News didn't want you to pray? Fox News. Fox News, war on Christmas, war on Christianity, Fox News, every year. Oh, my God, Christians are persecuted. They're so persecuted. They didn't want you to talk about God. They didn't want you to pray. Glenn, you're just a fucking liar. You're a liar. Look, with different right-wing characters, it's different things going on. So there are some right-wing commentators who are just idiots, and they're not that bright. And there are some that are lying to you. Glenn Beck, without question, is lying to you. He's a narcissist, he's a buffoon, and he'll say anything as long as he thinks he'll get more eyeballs on him. And this is unbelievably and shamelessly made up. Now, Fox News responded, and I actually love their response. They say, Glenn Beck wasn't trying to save his soul. He was trying to save his ass. Advertisers fled his show, and even Glenn knows what that means in our industry. Yet, we still tried to give him a soft landing. Guess no good deed goes unpunished. Ain't that the truth? Fox, you should have tore this guy down at the time. But again, I know you guys are crazy too, so you're always looking out for another right-wing idiot buddy. But there you have it, man. And look, I made a prediction a while ago, and I'll reiterate that prediction today. Glenn Beck's media empire is a paper tiger. It will collapse. Okay, and I'm not basing that just off my gut feeling, because I'm not like these far-right kooks who do that. I'm basing it off of endless articles I've read where they explain the chaos behind the scenes. And you guys, if you've ever watched his channel, you know that all they have is, you know, they're running ads for survival kits and dried food and guns. It's all like small money advertisers because they're the only people that will fucking advertise with them. And they can't stay afloat on just that money. They just can't do it. And these guys, Glenn Beck, Rush Limbaugh, Hannity, Levin, they're all giant welfare queens to the right-wing think tanks. They can't make it in the free market anymore. Are you kidding me? You think they can make it in the free market? No. Their ratings are horrible, so right-wing think tanks subsidize them, and their advertisers have all ran away a long time ago. So as soon as the right-wing think tanks cut off the funds, it's a wrap. It's a wrap. And Glenn has already made comments of like, you know, I don't think I want to do this forever. I think I want to get into other things here too. That's his way of saying, okay, we're in debt. We're in trouble. They're going to cut off the funding at the right-wing think tanks. Our advertisers aren't enough to keep us afloat. We're done. I gotta find something new. We're done. So, you know, you heard me say it before. You're hearing it again now. I think the Glenn Beck media empire will collapse within 5 years. Okay. I am going to take a break. And then when we come back, I still have 6 amazing stories for you, including Ted Cruz's dad sat down with Pat Robertson and waved that theocrat flag high. And then I got new conspiracy theories, this time on Justice Scalia's death, and a whole bunch more, including people randomly want to know why I refer to myself as a militant agnostic. I will answer that question. Somebody asked David Pakman about that question, which is kind of funny because, as David said, why would you ask him? But anyway, so I'll discuss that and much more. Stay right there, guys. Son of a bitch. All right, we're back, guys. Ted Cruz. Well, actually, his daddy, you know, between Chelsea Clinton going for Hillary and Raphael going for Ted out there on the campaign trail, it might be time for a new rule. Don't let your family do this dumping thing for you. It usually doesn't work out very well. I can't believe Ted hasn't tried to reel in his dad. Well, actually, you know what? I can, because Ted is so fucking crazy, he probably listens to his dad and thinks, nailed it. Ted Cruz's dad, Raphael Cruz, sat down with Pat Robertson and continued his creepy fundamentalist talking points tour.
What do you see the parallels between the United States and Cuba? If you wanted to warn people, you've written a book and you said it's the time for action. What action should we be taking now?
Well, you know, we are where we are primarily because the church has been silent.
Mm-hmm.
For too many years, the church has believed this lie of separation of church and state that is neither in the Constitution nor in the Declaration. 1962, when prayer was taken out of schools, the church remained silent.
Mm-hmm.
When the Bible was taken out of school a year later, in 1963, the church remained silent. Their excuse is a political issue. How can you call prayer a political issue? How can you call Bible study a political issue? But that's what the church did. The consequence of that, teen pregnancy skyrocketed after 1963, as so did violent crime. 10 years later,
mm-hmm.
when abortion was legalized, the church again remains silent. Same excuse, it's a political issue. Well, you know, we have what we deserve. June 26th, when we had this decision against traditional marriage by the Supreme Court,
yeah.
I'll tell you, this has been a wake-up call. How long are we going to remain silent?
What do you see the future of America right now as it stands?
I am very encouraged, Pat. I am very encouraged because precisely that decision on June 26th, I think the devil overplayed his hand.
Gay marriage is the devil overplaying his hand. Or it's people who give a shit about equality and justice and rights winning. It's people saying, hey, if you're not hurting anybody else, you should really be able to do whatever you want. Talking about consenting adults here. Now, these guys are amazing. And with Raphael Cruz, you know, you can make the argument, he meant metaphorically the devil won, and in his mind the devil are liberals. I don't know how much of a defense that is. But for him, it might be the case that it's literal. Like, he thinks, the devil with his horns and his tail and his fucking pitchfork. The devil overplayed his hand on gay marriage. Like, the devil is quite literally like, okay, I want gay people to get married. How can we work this out? Number one, the devil doesn't exist. Number two, if the devil existed, he wouldn't push for lovely things like gay marriage. He would push for, I don't know, more malaria and cancer and natural disasters. Death. No, these guys, their thinking is so warped because Pat Robertson and Raphael Cruz, they're legit fundamentalists. So they're totally brainwashed. They believe in their own Harry Potter nonsense. And it shows with every single thing that they say here. So I like how in Raphael Cruz's mind, the church in America has just been silent. That's the problem, is that they've always laid down and said, liberals, you do whatever you want. The fuck are you talking about? We have many, unfortunately, many politicians who are out-and-out theocrats. We have people with tremendous followings in the U.S. who are evangelical Christians, fundamentalists. You're on one of the shows right now, okay? Granted, it's all super old people. But Pat Robertson, people forgot, he almost became president. I think it was in the 1970s or the 80s. I don't remember. I think it was the 80s. The moral majority, they called it. Jerry Falwell, John Hagee, all these different characters. Rick Santorum was an elected official. Mike Huckabee almost beat Mitt Romney not that long ago. Not almost. I mean, he was pretty significantly behind. But these guys are guys who have won states. They win Iowa, for example. Ted Cruz now, your fucking son, just won Iowa. I mean, there's a significant 25% chunk of the country that's super evangelical, super fundamentalist, and that's a conservative number, 25%. And they want all the things you want, Christianity down everybody's throats, no abortion, you name it, whatever your Christian issue is du jour, they're on top of that. So they haven't been silent. and they don't even understand the Constitution. Like he said there, oh, the lie of separation of church and state. We just fucking went through it, man. You're going to make me go back to it right now and tell you exactly what they said. Okay, the first line of the First Amendment, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. That's the separation of church and state. The first line of the First Amendment, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, no state religion. And then Thomas Jefferson literally said we should, quote, build a wall of separation between church and state. What part of that is not clear? All right, and then you get, of course, the ridiculous comments with no correlation whatsoever, but you slap them together because you're a dunce, where Rafael Cruz goes, you know, hey, we took prayer out of school. Teen pregnancy went up. Nailed it. What the fuck are you saying? Yeah, I'm sure there's a direct link there. You took prayer out of school. Then there was more crime. Let me tell you. There's no link between those things in any way, shape, or form. You want to know the best way to prevent teen pregnancy? I don't know. Contraception? Sex education? Free clinics? Planned Parenthood? The pill? No, that's not an answer, except it works for the thing that you say you want to reduce, but that's not an answer because I just want people to stop fucking. Well, what a wonderful plan. I'm sure that'll work. Hey, you, stop being horny and having sex. Love Jesus. God will save everything. Okay, that's just not the case. So, there you have it, man. As he's calling for theocracy, he's like, these things aren't even political issues. To him, it's an of course. Like, of course the church should run the government, obviously. Again, you'd fit in better in Iran or Saudi Arabia. He literally said prayer in school, this isn't a political issue. Of course it's a political issue. It's public schools, government schools. It's our tax dollars funding it. To have our tax dollars fund prayer in school, you are establishing a religion. You are saying, what kind of prayer are we going to do? I'm sure you're in favor of doing a Hindu prayer, a Muslim prayer, a Christian prayer, and all kinds of different prayers, right? No, you're not. You want fucking Christian prayer. That is establishing a religion. It's tax dollars funding a specific religion over other religions. The most wildly unconstitutional thing you can imagine. But in Rafael Cruz's mind, that's an of course. Of course the church should run the government. I mean, this isn't even a political issue. My religion should dominate you, and you need to shut the fuck up about it. Okay. Now, we go to, oh God, we got it right here, the conspiracy theories on Justice Scalia's death. This is going to be good. You should have seen my face as I was listening to this for the first time. Conservative radio host and certified lunatic Rick Wiles is already out with a conspiracy theory on Justice Scalia's death. And who killed him? Obama.
This is a deadly gang to mess with. They're deadly. They mean business. This is about ruling the world. And they're Luciferian. They're devil worshippers. That's the other thing. Did we talk about the possible occult connections to this?
We didn't mention it. Actually, I think you're going to talk a little bit with Steve Carell coming up here with it. But in short, Lupercalia began on February 13th.
What is that?
It's an ancient celebration that people date back to Rome, where people come together, they sacrifice dogs, goats, and they do a bunch of crazy stuff with women. It's a fertility festival.
This is an ancient pagan day. And when was it?
February 13th was the beginning of it. February 13th to the 15th.
Which was the day he died?
Yes.
Okay, the other thing, and I noticed this, the 13th was the 44th day of 2016.
Right.
Obama is the 44th president of the United States. So you have this numerology thing taking place. It's like they sacrifice. There's always human sacrifice involved. What else is this? What's the name of this pagan day?
Lupercalia.
And it's connected to ancient Rome?
to ancient Rome.
To what did it signify with Rome?
Well, with Rome, the Latin concept at the beginning of the word luper, lupus, for wolf, it actually signified the birth of the nation, of the empire of Rome.
The birth of the Roman Empire.
I didn't realize.
Okay, now wait a minute. I'll tell you what comes to my mind right now. All right. Washington, D.C. is full of pagan Roman sculptures,
right.
Artwork. There's a lot of pagan Roman stuff in Washington, D.C. And then you have the fascist symbols. That is where we get the word fascist. They are engraved in the U.S. Senate on the wall or the ceiling of the U.S. Or it's in the Capitol building. I'm speaking here without my notes, but they're engraved in the U.S. Senate,
and that's where we get the word
fascism.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yes. So the birth of the Roman system, the birth of fascism, and it was on that day, the 13th.
Wow. Wow.
So they killed a Supreme Court justice.
On the day of the birth of fascism.
Yes. This is the way a dictatorial fascist police state regime takes control of a nation.
Like the mafia.
The mafia. Yes, exactly.
I enjoyed every second of that clip. I have a very simple question for Rick Wiles and his yes-man bitch-boy buddy there. When Obama leaves office, the day he leaves office and the next president comes in, will you come out and apologize? Very simple question. You just said it's a fascist takeover. This is what happens with police states. This is what they do. It's like the mafia. Okay, well, when he steps down and the next one comes in, will you go, my bad, bro. I was off on that one. You know, hey, I thought he was going to stay forever. I thought this was a power move. Whoops! And look, that every step of that made less sense than the one before. I like how you say all these disparate things, and then at the end you're like, they killed him. You didn't establish that in any way. He's like, you know, Obama's the 44th president of the United States, and then if you look at the clock and you mix it with the calendar, you get to the 44th day in 2016. But if you divide by the square root of pi and you add 0.2 and you take the common denominator and you multiply by – what the fuck are you saying? What are you saying? And actually there's a part of that clip that I cut out as well where he goes on to give this long description, numerology. They're all into numerology, this and that, yada, yada. And then he's like, yeah, it's their religion. Wait, you're the one that just used numerology. Not them. You just used it. Like, yeah, no, that's what they believe. You just explained that this is one of the reasons why you think they killed Scalia. The numerology works. Whose religion is it again? Unbelievable. These guys are so immensely stupid. And look at the claims. They're Luciferian devil worshippers. Well, Obama's a devil worshipper. You got him, bro. You got him. And then they're occult believers. And they're pagans and fascists. All these things, bad word, bad word, bad word, fix them all together. Yeah, here, this is what they are. Throw the mud at the wall and hope it sticks. And even the part like, I mean, obviously the boldest claims are the most ridiculous there, but they killed Scalia. But even like the minor details are dead wrong. So when he's like, you know where the term fascism comes from? It's a whale's vagina. No, he says it's from the sculptures and the Roman art in Washington, and that's where the term fascism comes from. That's not true at all. Fascism comes from the World War I era in Italy. It was Mussolini who was most known for making that term come into our consciousness. It had nothing to do. He's saying it predates that, and it was in America it came from. It didn't come from America. Dude, you know nothing about anything. These guys are lunatics. Look at what they do. They sit around all day. Instead of, like, reading articles and getting facts and trying to understand how the world works and using science and reason and logic, they sit around all day and they're like, let's see here. What are the occult worshippers doing? Oh, my goodness, the Christians are under attack. We have pagans over there that are trying to take over the country. The Luciferians, the devil worshippers. They killed Scalia. They killed Scalia. None of that is connected, and you've given no evidence as to why you think Scooby was killed by him. By the way, Alex Jones is also running with this conspiracy. Of course he is. He's fucking Alex Jones. And what's their key piece of evidence? In one of the original statements, somebody said, ooh, he was found with a pillow over his head. That's it. Must be a murder. Now, they asked the guy who reported that, the owner of the ranch, and he came back later, and he was like, well, yeah, but the pillow was over his head, but he looked like he was resting comfortably, and he died while he was in his sleep. Nothing looked out of place there. Okay, so the guy who saw him was like, no, nothing looked out of place. What are you talking about? They're like, no, but you said the thing about the pillow. That's it. Conversation's over. It was obviously a murder. And then the other thing they point to is the guy who owns the ranch had gotten a medal from Obama for something he did in war. And they go, see, when they met at the ceremony, Obama was telling him, so this thing is all planned, right? You're going to off Scalia on that day, right? And I love the conspiracy theory has the picture of him with Obama, and they're like, this happened just before the event. Actually, the picture was taken in 2009 at the ceremony where the guy got his medals. You're telling me in 2009, Obama met the guy who's the head of the hunting ranch in Texas where Scalia died, and he told him, now in 2016, Scalia's going to take a trip there, and I need you to kill him. Trip was not planned in 2009 for 2016, and there's no evidence that this guy offed Antonin Scalia, and they go, well, it wasn't an autopsy. Well, yeah, because the family said, we don't want an autopsy. Snopes has this long article debunking all the stupid fucking claims about how, shocker, an overweight 79-year-old died from a heart attack. Oh, my God, unbelievable. They break down all the facts of it and show you how it's bullshit. But this is the kind of level conspiracy we're talking about. These geniuses here with their Luciferian and their devil worshippers and their occult believers and their pagans and their fascists. And that's why they killed him. And they're going to do a police state takeover of America. They already did it. Okay, well, like I said at the beginning, will you apologize when they don't do that? I'll hold my breath. Actually, I'd die if I hold my breath. I won't hold my breath. All right. Let's keep going here. I got a lot more to get to. Time to go to Mr. Pompous Douchebag himself, Stuart Varney. Stuart Varney of Fox Business Network is going to talk about the issue of women in the military. And he's going to do it with the special ops guy who killed bin Laden. Now, there were some restrictions on women in some roles until recently. Now, all of the restrictions are gone, and as long as they meet the criteria and the standards, they're allowed to be in any position. And this segment did not go as Stuart Varney had planned.
Women can go into active service and into combat. All across the field of the Pentagon's forces. Special forces say women are not prepared for duty on the front lines, or they're not prepared to bring them in at this point. Rob O'Neill is with us. He's the man who shot Osama bin Laden. He is a former Navy SEAL. What do you make? Can I ask you for a flat-out judgment? Do you think that women should be part of special op teams that go in and shoot down Osama bin Laden?
Well, Stuart, thanks for having me today. You know, I've operated with women. They've actually come with us on special operations. We use them a lot for some of the searching of women and children, cultural sensitivity type stuff. Also, another thing that I know that these Islamic fighters, they don't fear death, but they do fear hell. And if they're killed by women, they go to hell, as far as they know. So, I mean, I like to say, you know, lock and load, ladies. If they don't lower the standards, and they can pass them, yeah, I think they should get shot.
That's interesting. If they don't lower the standards and they pass the standards and for everybody else, you have no problem with that. And Rob, I've never been in combat. I've never fired a gun in anger in my life. I've never been shot at either. Barely been in a fist fight. But you know, I don't understand combat. But are you telling me that you're perfectly okay going into a life and death situation with a woman by your side? I'm told that it changes the dynamics of the group that you're operating with.
It could potentially change the dynamic, and the last thing I'm suggesting is we make the military, especially special operations, a social experiment. But if the standards stay the same, you know, it's equal opportunity type stuff. If they can make it, you know, I don't Most of the men that try out for Navy SEALs don't make it. I think an even greater number of women wouldn't make it if they're going to try. But if they don't lower the standards, yes, they should be able to. And okay. there's definitely a place for women, too. There's different certain intelligence operations and reconnaissance type stuff. Women and men working together is better.
I just wonder. I think men have a sort of hunter-gatherer mentality. They go out and break things and kill people. I wonder if I'm on dangerous ground here, and I know it. Okay, I know I'm.
I think we both are.
You know, we're both on dangerous ground here. But you get where I'm coming from. You see my point? Without me actually.
No, I just hear it out.
Oh, the way that ended was glorious. Because it's Stuart Varney who's like, you know, I don't have a reason that's not going to get torn down by people that are smarter than me. So, you know what I'm saying? Women. You know what I'm saying? Do I have to say it? I don't have to say it, do I? You know what I'm saying. Broads. Am I right? No, you're not right. You're not right. Dude, he explained it. And by the way, that's my position 100%, where he goes, as long as you don't lower the standards, yeah, women should be allowed. Anybody should be allowed. If you're not lowering the standards, you're just saying, hey, you have to be able to do the same things that the men can do in order to get into this. Why would you be against it? The only argument they pivot to is basically the one that Varney made there, which is it changes the dynamic. You know, it's different to have a woman there, you know. And what that means is, what I perceive from that, you guys can tell me if you disagree, but when you dig deeper, and I've had conversations with people where they make this argument, you dig deeper, and they admit it eventually, where they say, well, I mean, it really comes down to there's, a gender and sexual dynamic there where you don't want – if you want it to be all the guys so that nobody's interested in the sexual angle when you're going into combat. And it's like, okay, well, then just be clear about the argument you're making. You're saying the men can't control themselves in that realm. Which is an argument made in Islamic theocracies as to why women need to cover the fuck up in the street. Look, I'm all in favor of women's rights, but you got to cover your fucking face. You don't want a man seeing your hair and getting hard and not being able to control himself. You don't want to invite sexual assault against you, right? I mean, you would have had it coming if you were showing your hair. This is what they're getting at here. And look, again, maybe I'm wrong. I'm open to further. If you guys want to say, no, what he really means is X, and you tell me what you think he meant, I'd be more than happy to evaluate the argument. But there's a reason why he's stopping short and he's not giving more detail, because whatever the reasoning is, it's weak-ass reasoning. Because the reality is, as long as you can meet the standards, why would you object to them joining? And on what possible grounds? The only other thing I can think of is just this blanket generalized idea that Stuart Varney has about the sexes, which is so concrete and set in stone that he doesn't even allow for exceptions to it. This idea of like, well, they're just different than us. You know, women, they're just not the same as us, and we have these different, you know, drives, and that's the end of the conversation. So now we need a blanket rule to stop all women from getting the position. But the way I would respond to that is, look, nobody's denying that, like, it's a scientific fact that men, on average, are stronger. They have more muscle tissue than women do. Women have a higher fat content. There's literally chemical and hormonal differences. So there are like biological differences between men and women. Nobody denies that. And there's even a truth angle to the hunter-gatherer thing and the nurturer thing. There's a truth angle to that as well. But as Stuart Varney even admitted there are exceptions to the rule. Stuart Varney was like, I never fought in combat. I never want to fight in combat. I can't really do something like that. I'm kind of a bitch. And look, I'm with Stuart Varney on that. I'm kind of a bitch too. So in the spectrum, I'm more on the side of, you know, a male who doesn't have those that aggressive hunter-gatherer mentality. Now, on the flip side of that, there are women who do have that more than some males. There are variations within the genders, which is why you don't do generalized blanket rules and say, all women are stopped. No, not all women. Look, I would object to the policy if they try to do some bullshit quota system. The population is about 50% male, 50% female, therefore specialized needs to be 50% male, 50% female. No, that's stupid, because then what if more women don't meet the standards? What if you don't find as many women that want to do the role? You know, I say they should be allowed, they just have to meet the same standards as the men, and if at the end of the day the ratio is it's 90% men, 10% women, so be it. So there is an idea that's, I think, too liberal for me, a quota system where you make women do it and they don't even necessarily want to do it. But that's the thing, nobody's proposing that right now. If they do propose that, I'll be against it. If they want to lower the standards, I'll be against it. But it's just about, hey, if you can meet the same standards, should you be able to do it? The answer is yes. Because if you say no, what you're saying is, I am generalizing. It is all of you who are not worthy. I have now decreed and decided that I will define your role in society. That sounds very similar to the 50s, doesn't it? Get in the kitchen and shut the fuck up. That's your job. That's the space that you need to be in. It's just how you are and how I am. Hey, you're biologically made for a role that's more like that. You are the nurturer after all, right? There's no natural deviation. There's no women who want that to do that less than others and more than others. So just know that's your spot, and I'm not even going to let you go anywhere else. Not even an option. No. They should have any option they fucking want, and whatever they choose to do, they should do. If they want to be a housewife, I support them 100%. If they want to, you know, get in the military and fight and they can meet the standards, I support them 100%. You know, this is nuanced, rational thinking, something Stuart Varney knows nothing about. Okay. All right, I got 5 minutes left. Means I can only squeeze in uno mas, uno noche, as 98 Degrees used to say. What does that mean again? It means one night, right? I think so. Props on the random 98 Degrees reference. All right, let's do it. David and Lewis over at the David Pakman Show were asked a question about me, randomly. So let's listen to their back and forth here.
For Kyle Kaminsky, I noticed that on their different bio, it says militant agnostic.
Right.
What exactly does that mean? Like, especially the militant part.
You can easily get a hold of Kyle, right? I mean, he's on Twitter, he's got a Facebook page, etc. I don't know why anyone would contact me. Like, who am I to be the spokesperson for what Cenk and Kyle's views are?
That's a nice title, though. You wield a lot of power if that's... anyway, what is a militant agnostic?
Yeah.
I would just say someone who is very passionate about convincing other people that they should also be agnostic.
But that's the thing. If you, to me, now, I mean, now we're actually getting into it, and maybe Kyle can give us feedback about this. To me, militant agnostic means you are absolutely committed to being open-minded about the existence of God, but until you have evidence that there is a God, you you have no particular reason to think that there is a God. That's what it seems to me. You're committed to the idea that we don't know and we don't have any evidence that there is a God.
Well, that's just agnostic, not necessarily a militant agnostic.
Yeah, so I don't even know what that would mean.
I really enjoyed that segment because they actually both were trying to, like, no, I think this is what it is. I think this is what it is. So they were trying to flesh it out and get to an answer there. Now, thankfully, I'm right here, so I'll tell you guys. So for the record, I'm an agnostic atheist. That's how I describe myself, and both terms apply, and I'll explain that in detail now. Now, the term militant agnostic, which I had used on my YouTube thing and perhaps on Twitter at one point, that was all based on this awesome and hilarious bumper sticker that I saw that I really liked, where it said, "Militant agnostic, I don't know and you don't either." Because I think that's just so immensely accurate, where you have people part of all the different religions who are, my God is true. No, this is what I think happens. Even the, like, goofy spiritual people who are like, well, I think it's all energy, bro, and that's nature, and blah, 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 blah. And I always thought, shut up, all of you. I don't know, and you don't either. End of conversation. So that's, like, the militant agnostic position. And I thought that bumper sticker was awesome, which is why I had adopted that label. Now, to dig deeper here, like I said, in reality, I'm an agnostic atheist. And what that means is there are two parts to this. One question is, what do you believe? The other question is, what do you know? Now, in terms of knowledge, do I know that there's not a God? No, I don't think anybody knows, which is why I'm an agnostic. But in terms of belief, do I actively believe in a God? No. Do I live my life as if there's a God? No. So in terms of my belief, I believe there's no God because there's no evidence for it. That's the atheist part. So when you mix the two together and you have the two separate questions, knowledge versus belief, you can come away with the title agnostic atheist, and it's not a contradiction. And look, this is the position that I honestly think is probably the only intellectually honest position, because it's getting very specific and drilling down the two questions here, belief versus knowledge, and it's just being perfectly straightforward about your answers to both of them. You don't know if there's a God. Nobody knows. You don't have that knowledge, so you're agnostic because you don't know. In terms of your belief, I think the honest people would say, or they wouldn't believe in a God because there's no evidence to believe in a God, so in that sense, they're an atheist. So I hope I cleared that up a little bit, but I may have confused it more because indeed I added another part to it. I'm not just a militant agnostic, although I do accept the agnostic label. I'm an agnostic atheist, and I think both parts of that are relevant. Okay, I'm out of time, guys. I love you. We'll see you back here tomorrow, same time, same place. Everybody have a great rest of the day. Peace.